This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Scientists exploring the Gulf of Mexico have discovered a patch of dead and dying coral. It is 7 miles from the site of the blown-out BP oil well, and the scientists suspect the coral was harmed by the spill. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
Researchers set out on a government research vessel in October to continue a 4-year-long study of corals in the Gulf of Mexico. Chuck Fisher from Penn State University was on the trip.
For most of this cruise, what we saw were healthy coral communities at depths from 500 to 2,500 meters all over the Gulf of Mexico.
Or all under the Gulf of Mexico, because at these great depths, we're not talking about reefs teeming with colorful fish, but corals that live in the dark on the seafloor. Fisher says the scientists were feeling pretty good about what they saw up until they made their last dive using a robotic mini-sub just 7 miles from the site of the Deepwater Horizon disaster.
From the moment the community came into sight, it was pretty clear that this didn't look like the other corals we'd been looking at for the past 3 weeks.
The sea fan corals, normally bright gold or orange, were clearly in bad shape. Fisher says it was evident that many were dead or dying.
Corals that were in the process of losing tissue, that were covered with a scummy brown flocculent material, areas of recently dead skeleton.
Fisher says he and his colleagues took samples of the coral they will now analyze in order to see what caused the damage. But he strongly suspects that it has to do with the oil or maybe the chemical dispersants from the disaster.
We've never come across a community of dying corals, and to find them at that place and at this time is very strong circumstantial evidence, I think, that it's related to the spill.
The good news here is that so far, at least, it seems to be an isolated case and not a sign of trouble throughout the Gulf. Richard Harris, NPR News.
And now, down to some seedy business with cookbook author Dory Greenspan.
I think I'm at the point where I need a spoon to just scrape the stuff up from the bottom.
We've cut a cap out of a small pumpkin, that little place where the stem sits, and now we're gutting it, something many of us do only before Halloween, but a necessary first step for a recipe Dory calls pumpkin stuffed with everything good. And the good in this case? Breadcrumbs, Gruyere cheese, garlic, scallions, thyme, nutmeg, heavy cream, and bacon, crispy bacon. Now I know, bacon and pumpkin. I, too, was very skeptical about this combination.
I love this recipe because it has almost no rules. So you can play with it. You can change the filling a million different ways. You could add spinach or chard, or once I used, more than once, some leftover cooked rice. And so instead of the breadcrumbs, I put rice in it. It became almost like risotto. You can put nuts, you can put apples, you can put chestnuts.
Whatever you do with it, Dory says, pumpkin stuffed with everything good is the perfect cold weather main course. It's a recipe from her new cookbook, Around My French Table. And like most of her dishes, it comes with a story.
My friend Aileen, my wonderful friend Aileen Samuel in Paris, had told me about this dish, and I thought, oh, that's nice, that's nice. And finally she said, you know, you're not paying attention to me. This is a great dish. You have to make it. And she said, I'm going to have my sister send you the recipe. So her sister lives in Lyon, and she said, here's how I make it, but I'm sure you'll make it a different way, and maybe you'll improve on it. But there was one thing that I couldn't improve on, and that was her pumpkin. Her husband's a farmer, and he grows pumpkins. And when the pumpkins are very, very small, she goes into the fields with her children, and they carve their name in the pumpkins. And then as the pumpkins grow, their names grow with the pumpkin. And then they each have their own pumpkin to make this dish.
Oh, my goodness.
Isn't that great?
That sounds wonderful.
Yeah.
Monogram.
A monogram pumpkin, a personalized pumpkin.
So, Dory, we've carved open our perfect little pumpkin without monogram, but still very cute.
It's the shape of this one is particularly nice. It's a very cute pumpkin.
And I take that you don't just throw everything inside the pumpkin. Is there a very careful process for layering all the ingredients?
Guess what? You throw everything into the pumpkin.
Okay, recipes rarely get easier than this. We mix the bread, cheese, garlic, herbs, and yes, the bacon together in a bowl. Then we stuff it into our nearly 3-pound pumpkin. Next, we stir nutmeg plus some salt and pepper into heavy cream before pouring it into the pumpkin.
The nutmeg's there because I like it. And I like nutmeg and cheese as a combination. And of course, nutmeg and pumpkin is classic when you're making pie. Mm-hmm.
We return the top to the pumpkin, that little cap, and then into the oven it goes, 350 degrees for 2 hours. While we wait, we talk more about France. Dory has lived there part-time for about 13 years, and while her experiences with French chefs and bakers have influenced her own approach to cooking, there are just some American conveniences she cannot do without.
You can't find canned pumpkin.
Which is a staple here.
I carry it over in my suitcase. I mean, every recipe that you see for a pumpkin puree starts by cutting the pumpkin, roasting it, and pureeing it. And
which adds quite a bit of time to
and
the preparation.
And good flavor. I mean, there's nothing better than roasted pumpkin. But when I want pumpkin muffins, I want them now.
Here we go.
Let's see how our little baby is doing.
When our baked pumpkin comes out of the oven, it's a deep burnished orange. It's just beautiful. And the smell, oh, it's heavenly. It's so soft that when I slice it into wedges draped with melted cheese and bacon, it practically sighs as it gently collapses, surrenders onto my plate. Oh, and the taste.
Who wouldn't love this?
I can't place it. I mean, the filling is a familiar, you know, the bacon and the cheese and the breadcrumbs. But melding that with a pumpkin is unlike anything I've ever had before.
When I first had it, I had exactly the same feeling. And yet, could there be anything more American?
Are you talking to me? I'm sorry.
I'm sorry.
I'm so deep into this dish that I barely heard anything you said.
No,
something about this being
important.
American?
Well,
yes,
it's
yes.
Not important.
I know that
I'm
this
glad
is,
you're liking it.
I am. And I know that this is a French dish, but it's become American now because it will definitely get a repeat performance in this American kitchen.
This is exactly what I'm hoping for. Culinary diplomacy will bring the world together with food.
Dory Greenspan's new cookbook is Around My French Table. You can find a picture of pumpkin stuffed with everything good, and of course the recipe, at npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. If I told you that motor vehicle accidents are the leading cause of traumatic brain injury in young people, you probably would not be surprised, right? But do you know what ranks right behind motor vehicle accidents? Sports. Yep, like football, hockey, baseball. Earlier this week, the American Academy of Neurology said it's time to change the way we deal with concussions in athletes. Included in the new recommendations, any athlete who gets hit hard should be removed from the game and evaluated by a doctor trained to handle concussions. They also recommend that a certified athletic trainer be present at all sporting events for kids and adults, including practices. Joining me now to talk about concussions and the new recommendations is my guest, Dr. Jeffrey Kutcher. He is chair of the Sports Neurology Section at the American Academy of Neurology. He's also director of Michigan Neurosport and the team physician for the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Kutcher.
Thank you, Robert. Great to be here.
Let's talk about a little bit some ground rule definitions. What is a concussion?
Sure. A concussion is a physiological injury. We understand when a force is applied to the brain and the brain moves quickly, it disrupts neuronal function. So it is not so much a structural injury in the classic sense. There's no swelling, there's no bleeding, there's no cell death, but there is a disruption of neuronal function which causes symptoms that we typically, you know, describe as the clinical syndrome of concussion.
Mm-hmm. And I was surprised to read that it's true that concussions are second only to motor vehicle accidents, sports concussions?
Well, that's an estimate from the CDC, and I think it illustrates both how common concussion can be in sport, but also just the vast number of people that play sports in this country.
And what about these new recommendations? You're saying anybody hit hard should be immediately taken off the field.
Well, actually, the recommendation is anybody who is suspected to have suffered a concussion. So it's not just being hit hard, but and this is where it gets into people who have experience on the sidelines and evaluating athletes have a much better sense as to what hit, what kind of hit, what symptoms to look for. In those cases, all those athletes should be removed and evaluated further.
And so you're saying then that you need those specially trained people to evaluate the people, so they have to be there during the game.
That would be the best case scenario, sure.
Yeah, but how realistic do you think that is?
Well, not very overall. I think this highlights that the position statement that we put out on Monday are recommendations. They're the best case scenarios. These are things that we think we should take as priorities, and we understand that they're not at the level of regulation. So I think it's something that we have to think seriously about. And try to reorganize our priorities a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Are you concerned about athletes that suffer multiple concussions or just one concussion at a time?
Well, I think that the important thing here is that not only are all concussions different, but all athletes are different, and individuals will respond differently to one or multiple concussions. And we need to move beyond the concept that we treat concussion like a very simple, straightforward injury. You know, three means you're out, four means you're out, that kind of thing doesn't apply. So it really depends on that individual story. But in a general sense, we are starting to feel that there's some evidence that multiple concussions may lead to long-term consequences. But that story is just being told, and we need to do a lot of research to figure that out.
Mm-hmm. We reported earlier this year about new research into the long-term effects of concussions, what those effects may have on pro athletes. Do these recommendations stem from the pro athlete recommendations?
In some ways, they do. I think, you know, our goal, and I will say it's also the goal of many other physician groups, anybody who takes care of athletes, you know, our goal is to look out for the health of those athletes, and that's from, you know, ages, mm-hmm. youth sports, all the way to the pros. So in some ways, you know, they're all kind of similar, and we need to be looking out for our junior high kids as much as our high school kids, as college kids and pro kids.
And I remember some of those reports were saying that even Lou Gehrig himself might not have suffered from Lou Gehrig's disease. It might have been from repeatedly getting hit in the head.
I think that's a little stretch. And I say that because there were some cases described where there were damaged motor neurons in the same way that cortical neurons in the brain were found to be damaged in some athletes who had multiple hits. But that certainly doesn't mean that Lou Gehrig didn't have ALS, and it doesn't mean that trauma causes ALS. It's a different entity altogether.
Mm-hmm. In hockey, there was a recommendation about hockey. People are hit in the head all the time there.
Yeah, and you know, it's not always being hit to the head, though, either. I want to emphasize that. You can get a concussion from any time the brain moves quickly. So whether that's a blow to the body or the head, it has nothing to do with the actual force that hits the skull. So it doesn't have to be just a hit to the head.
Mm-hmm. There was a story earlier this week that concussions were being underdiagnosed in hockey players.
I think we need to be better about diagnosing. I think in some ways, a lot of times concussions are underdiagnosed, but also I think they're overdiagnosed in some other instances, and we need to be better at clarifying when somebody has a concussion.
Let me see if I can get a call or two from our listeners. Let's go to Amy in Kensington, New Hampshire. Hi, Amy.
Hi, how are you?
Hi there.
I had a quick question. My son plays soccer, which normally you wouldn't consider a high-impact sport, but now that they're playing indoors, especially with the concrete floors, he really has taken some hits and hit his head on the ground. I've heard that mouth guards can help protect him against concussion. I was wondering if that was true and if it's something we should be doing.
That's a great question. It's a common question, and in general, a common misconception that mouth guards do prevent concussions. They have been shown in studies I've seen in the laboratory to decrease the amount of force in a test dummy, for example, that gets through to the test dummy's brain. But nobody has shown clinically in studies with enough data that it makes a difference. That being said, I always preface that answer with wear your mouth guards because they're great at preventing oral injuries, but I wouldn't expect them to make a difference in concussion at all.
Thanks for calling, Amy.
Great. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Yep. You've said that these are unrealistic. They're sort of the gold standard recommendations that there should be knowledgeable professionals on the field watching these kids after, you know, for signs of after they're being hit. Could these be like volunteer parents who are doctors, or you're talking about really assigning people there full time?
Well, again, it's sort of a priority. I think if we could get certified athletic trainers at all events, that would be the best case scenario, and you know, more feasible than having sports medicine physicians or sports neurologists. But you know, in lieu of that, we need to do whatever we can to educate mm-hmm. the people that are there, the coaches, the parents, the teammates, the athletes themselves, the school nurses, whoever is available. We need to raise that bar,
right.
And this starts, you know, at all ages, mm-hmm. all areas of sport, both in schools and private clubs. We really need to get the word out.
Has the definition of a concussion changed over the years? Are there more subtle symptoms that coaches or trainers should be looking for that they may not have known in the past to look for?
The definition itself may not have changed all that much, but I think our awareness of what concussion can present like has, and it is more than just sort of the obvious, most common presentation of a headache and dizziness and some nausea, sensitivity to light, confusion. Those are sort of the common ones, but you can also see a personality change. You can see individuals just being more introspective or more manic. You can really sort of scan the whole brain function list of what the brain does, and anything that can get affected, you can see. And so it can be a lot of different things.
Mm-hmm. Caroline in Anchorage, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Yes, good morning. My question has to do with the young child's brain. I saw recently Toyota's promoting a football league for kids under the age, it looks like they're under the age of 8, 6, and 5-year-olds, and they're running with full gear. What is the damage to them, and should we have parents sign a waiver with that as a major possibility, future damage to them because of concussive mm-hmm. hits when they're that young? Because it just seemed, it was like, this is the worst PR thing I've ever heard anybody do after all that's been published. But anyway, that's what's happening with a promotion from a major company.
Let's get an answer. Thanks for calling.
That's a great question. And the short answer is we don't know what these impacts are doing to the younger brains. I mean, one feeling is that as a brain is developing, we want to be more careful, we want to be more conservative and limit the impacts, and it certainly makes sense. I can't point to any data that makes that statement more clearly, but you know, I think the idea is we want to look at total dose effect and not just do you have a clinical concussion, but how many hits is somebody taking over their lifetime?
Mm-hmm.
And is it worth having them start hitting at 8 or 9? They have to learn the game if they want to keep playing it, so at some point you have to introduce that contact. At that age, I will make the point, though, and this is just from my own clinical experience, the football players at that age typically aren't generating enough speed, and they pretty much just fall over each other. It's the hockey players at that age that I really are worried about because they can skate a little faster and generate a little more force.
Would that include the women's or girls' field hockey? You don't hear much about that.
Well, absolutely. You know, any sport where athletes are moving fast or objects are moving fast or on the field of play, you have to be concerned about. Field hockey has maybe a special consideration because they don't typically wear facial or head protection at all.
Yeah.
And so that's a sport that is definitely a concern.
Mm-hmm. And so where do you go with this research now? Anything else we could expect to hear from?
Well, I think there are so many questions that need to be answered. And one of the big ones is what are the long-term consequences? You know, do we really know what the risks are, and are all the things we're doing, all these guidelines we're coming up with, making a difference? And the only way to do that is to follow a population of athletes, a large population, early on and follow them through their careers. And that obviously will take a lot of money and a lot of organization. And we're working with different organizations now to try to set something like that up so that we can get a better sense as to what the long-term effects are. But beyond that, there's also a lot more research to do with protective equipment and rules and biomechanical forces, and the list just goes on and on.
Well, this is sort of homecoming month, Thanksgiving month. People are playing a lot of football. People will be talking about it.
Absolutely.
So this is a good time to get people to think about maybe getting some extra professional medical help on the field there if you really care about your kids. have people on the sidelines who know how to look for those symptoms.
That would be great.
All right. Thank you, doctor, for taking time to talk with us.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
Have a great day, too. Dr. Jeffrey Kutcher is a chair of the sports neurology section at the American Academy of Neurology, director of Michigan Neurosport, and a team physician for the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. We're going to take a break and come back and switch gears and talk about a new play that's out off-Broadway, Photograph 51. And it's playing here in New York at the Ensemble Studio Theater. We'll have some special guests from the play. It has to do with Rosalind Franklin. We've talked about her before. We'll talk about her again and see how it's treated in this play. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. As we've been reporting this morning, the economy added 151,000 jobs in October. President Obama noted today's figures from the Labor Department show job growth in the private sector for the last 10 months, but he cautioned.
Because the fact is, an encouraging jobs report doesn't make a difference if you're still one of the millions of people who are looking for work.
And despite the gains, the unemployment rate remains at 9.6%. NPR's Tamara Keith joins us live to sort through the new numbers. Good morning.
Good morning.
So economists had been predicting job growth of only about 60,000. So this number that did come out must be a real surprise.
It is a surprise. And it proved once again that the consensus isn't always right. Most of this job growth came from the private sector. And that is a good thing. Private employers created 159,000 jobs in October. And that was mostly in healthcare, retail, and temporary help services or temp workers. There were some losses on the government side, but really the banner here is that we have strong private sector job growth. Since the start of the year, 1.1 million jobs have been created by business owners and other employers. And we also got some revisions from the last 2 months, so August and September weren't as bad as originally thought.
Well, Tamara, how can we see, though, more than 150,000 jobs created and the unemployment rate doesn't even seem to move at all?
Well, 150,000 jobs created in a month is basically what economists say we need to keep up with population growth. So at the moment, the economy is now producing enough jobs to tread water. And with the revisions, we now have 4 months in a row of adding 100,000 private sector jobs, which is definitely better than sinking. But one economist I spoke to said we really need to see 200 to 250,000 jobs created a month and doing that consistently. Or in other words, we need to kick it up a gear or two or the unemployment rate could even rise.
Do these numbers give us a sense, though, of where the labor market is headed?
They do. One thing that economists look to, which is sort of buried in the report, is the length of the average work week. And in October, the average work week increased by 6 minutes or 0.1% to 34.3 hours a week. And that doesn't sound like much, but the needle is moving up and employers will increase worker hours before they add new employees. So seeing those hours increase even slightly is a good thing. Also, those temp employees that we mentioned, employers tend to hire temporary workers before they will hire permanent employees. And the hope is that employers will convert those temporary jobs into permanent ones.
Tamara, thanks very much.
Thank you.
NPR's Tamara Keith.
You're listening to Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. When Jon Stewart held his rally in D.C., he said that the success of the event would be measured by how many people showed up. And that seems true. We always watch for the official count. But just how do they count the crowd? For example, how many people attended the Million Man March? It depends on whom you ask. According to the U.S. Park Police, about 400,000. But the organizers of the march took issue with that number and asked for a recount. And using a different image, a crowd counting expert at Boston University estimated the crowd to be closer to 800,000, almost twice the number that the Park Service had. So what followed? The Park Service stopped publicizing its crowd counts and did not give them out anymore. But the controversy over the headcount didn't end or start there. According to my next guest, nearly every major protest or rally sparks a similar dispute over the numbers. There were disagreements over how many people attended President Obama's inauguration, Glenn Beck's rally at the mall. How do you count a crowd? Is there a scientific way to do it? Well, it's not as easy as you think, according to my guests. Clark McPhail is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Stephen K. Doig is a Knight Chair in Journalism at the Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University in Tempe. He's also part of a Pulitzer Prize-winning group in the Miami Herald for their 1993 coverage of Hurricane Andrew. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira.
Clark McPhail, is there a good way to count the number of people in the crowd? Why is it so hard? Do we get so many different numbers for these things?
Part of it is a matter of the perspective of the organizers, who are frequently looking at the rally from only a very slightly elevated vantage point on a rally platform, and right in front of them, the gathering tends to be very, very dense. And then as they look down through the depth of the gathering toward the end, they are tricked by something that's called foreshortened perspective. It appears that the density of the crowd immediately in front of them extends throughout the length of the gathering. And so what people have tried to do to overcome that is to get an overhead or an aerial, an elevated vantage point from which to look at the gathering. And there are three kinds of variables. Mm-hmm. You need to know how much, what the carrying capacity of the space is in which the gathering is arrayed, and what the square footage is. What's the carrying capacity? What proportion of that is occupied? Is it 100%, 75%, 50%? And then what is the density of the occupation? And that method was invented, really, by a journalism professor, Steve Doig, I'm sure is familiar with the story, Herb Jacobs, who had an office overlooking Sproul Plaza during the free speech movement back in the 60s, and he was curious about the size of the gathering in front, and so he invented this procedure. I don't know if we can call it scientific or not, but it is an objective procedure of the three variables that I've mentioned: carrying capacity, the proportion of the space occupied, and the density of the occupation. Mm.
So, Steve, if you know the square footage of the area and you know how the size of a person, can't you make a pretty good guess at how many people are there?
Right. You can certainly set limits, at least, a rational area in which the crowd size is likely to be. And that's usually the problem with crowd estimation, is in advance of the crowd, the organizers, no matter what the event, all too often come up with sort of hyped projections of what's going to be, and then they wind up having to show that their event was even more popular than they predicted, and so that's why you wind up with the overhyped ones. But the point of doing what Professor McPhail talks about is to set sort of rational boundaries on what actually could be there, and it's actually a simple math problem, as he points out.
How do you know how much space to allow an individual in those pictures?
What I do when I train students to make observations is to use the front page of newspapers. If you look at below the fold, that's about 1 1/4 square feet. The entire page is about 2 1/2 square feet. Two pages are 5 square feet, and so on. At the front of any gathering, the density is very high. It can be pretty close to 2 1/4 or even more dense than that. But as you move to the back and to the sides, it sparses out. So what the Park Service, the U.S. Park Police, has done over the years, working with the formulation that Jacobs developed, they just average out and use 5 square feet. Now, what Steve has been doing with Kurt Westergaard and the Air Photo Live organization is to do a little more discretionary estimation of density, and perhaps he can tell you about that.
Steve?
Sure. Yeah, it's the advantage you have when you have a nice overhead image of it is you can You can break the crowd up. You can take the image. You can grid it off. You can make estimates and see the differences that Professor McPhail is talking about. You know, clearly up in the front or in front of jumbotrons or whatever, you're going to get much higher density. But if you have a grid, you can make reasonable estimates of the density, basically the number of square feet per person that are being taken up, and use that to get a more nuanced density rather than just coming up with a single guess of say 5 square feet per person.
I was wondering that in this age of spy in the sky satellites, having been up in there for decades now, and facial recognition, you would think that some people in the military and in the intelligence service have already figured out some way of really getting an accurate count. We just don't know about.
You're quite correct about that. During the run-up to the 2009 inauguration, there were a number of people who were using satellite imageries, and one of the people that I came in contact with, her name is Allison Puccioni. She works now for Jane's Limited. But before she went to work for them, she was in the U.S. military, and she was doing satellite imagery analysis. And so you can get, you know, a very good image from several thousand feet in the sky, but it doesn't last very long because the satellite's going over, so you can't really follow changes across time, but it does a very good job of that.
There were beautiful images of the inauguration. There was a GOI satellite going over about 45 minutes before, and it was a fascinating picture of the crowd. You could really see that varying density across there because of it.
Mm-hmm. One would think that some company would go in the business of crowd measuring.
There is one.
Yeah. I'm always far behind.
Photo 5 is visibly doing it.
Yeah, and they're using, would you agree, accurate measurements, making accurate measurements of crowd?
Well, they've got
doing their best, I think.
Can you discuss just a bit the panoramic digital imagery that's attached to the weather balloon that you use, and tell people a little bit about how high that's tethered above the ground on which the gathering is assembled?
I'll tell you what I know about it. My problem is I'm actually in Portugal, and I've never actually seen the actual equipment, so I only know what I've been told. But what normally they do is they have a balloon, they have equipment that hangs from it. My understanding is it's going up around 700 feet. Mm-hmm. D.C. is a difficult area to get aerial images because there are not very many tall buildings around to get good overhead shots, and the airspace is very restricted. So the balloon approach is actually a clever solution to that problem. They have to get permits and so on. But
and the photographs are really very useful.
Should the Park Service start giving out those numbers again?
Yes, absolutely.
That'd be good. I'm sure they're doing. I would hope that they are continuing to do that internally. You just need that kind of thing for planning,
for budgetary reasons, for planning, for personnel requests, and things of that sort. I think there's another flawed way of getting an elevated vantage point. The Washington Monument is pretty high in the sky, and while you get some foreshortened perspective, at least looking down, you can see the length of the mall, and you can determine how many of the panels of the mall are occupied. And if you had always had photographs from the top of the Washington Monument, the Post could do it, and a reporter on the ground walking through the gathering to make estimates of the density, it seems to me that you could have a standardized way of doing that. Having said that, and I have nothing at all against private enterprise that Kurt Westergaard has developed, it seems to me that First Amendment rights of assembly and speech really merit an independent, non-commercial estimation that's systematic. I think if people understand how well that can be done, that you could have a way of showing the magnitude of support for or against the various kinds of issues that people assemble to protest or to push forward. So I would like to see the Park Service do it again, and certainly the technology has developed that they perhaps could do it better than what was possible before.
Mm-hmm. You agree, Steve?
I agree.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. I think it's good. I mean, the problem with rallies like this is the size of it becomes a totem, I guess, of right. how popular the event was.
Well,
it's incumbent on the press to provide some sort of independent estimate of that.
If you could get the perfect picture, overhead, no shadows, confusion, face recognition, something, what would be your margin of error? What would you be shooting for?
It's if you're talking margin of error, you're really dealing with sampling, and the best you could say is if you were trying. Well, there's another approach that can be done. You could grid it off and use something like the Mechanical Turk, which is the Amazon thing where you parcel out a large job into small pieces and basically have a whole bunch of people paid small amounts of money to try and actually count the heads in a, let's say, a random selection of squares, and then turn that into an estimate. Then you could have a real margin of error. In reality, the kinds of estimates that for instance I'm doing with the with the images, I make a guess, and then I'm basically doing a margin of error. I'm saying, well, it's probably within, 10 or 15% of whatever I'm guessing.
Right.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen, for taking time to be with us now. I want to thank Clark McPhail, who's Professor Emeritus of Sociology, University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and Stephen Doig, Knight Chair in Journalism at the Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University in Tempe. Thank you for being with us today.
Thanks. Enjoy the conversation.
My pleasure.
You're welcome. This is Science Friday from NPR.